We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And now New Galaxy Broadcasting presents Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition, a program addressing the grave challenges to human and citizen rights in America and the rest of the world. How can we, the people of Earth, take back the power and privileges granted to us by God and address so significantly in the Declaration of Independence? Our rights are inalienable, that is, given by God and incapable of being taken away from or given by another. These rights are the basis of liberty, the foundation of all life and happiness. The Coalition of Planetary Empowerment is an organization designed to give its members tools and information to empower them personally, in relationships, and in business and employment, but also to give them a voice and the ability to help transform political and corporate governance to support the true needs and desires of people throughout the world. Inalienable and Free focuses on the need for government and corporate business interests to be responsive to the will and desire of their constituents and consumer shareholders. Good morning. My name is Johnny Bluestar, and this is Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition. Our program today concentrates on an important component of smart political activism when dealing with people with opposite or very different articulated beliefs. I really just consciously honed in on this tool because of a chance meeting with Andy Miller on another podcast. He is with me today, and the specific tool that I mentioned is knowing what you, in fact, really want to accomplish in a social and political sense, and being able to cut through the rhetoric to achieve common ground with a person who shares an alternative or opposing opinion. It is one thing to say this. It is another thing to understand the way to do this. Andy is going to show us. But let me tell you something about Andy. Andy was born in Chicago to parents who were progressive thinkers for their generation. Andy's mother lobbied for libraries locally and nationally, winning awards for her promotion of literacy. Got a good start. And with his father, his father was also involved in community and civic affairs, and he introduced Andy to computers at a young age. And computers themselves were at a rather young age, I believe. Soon, Andy, dreaming of finding ways to apply technology to bring about a more humane society, began to develop educational computer software, industrial training applications, and software systems to aid in such efforts. In 1990, he began the development of a software tool that uses family systems theory to generate and model family emotional process diagrams, a tool aiding pastoral counselors, therapists, and others interested in understanding the intergenerational emotional inheritance to families and family members. Later, he developed another tool in diagramming family community environments, showing how we interact with our emotional communities and how they interact with us. This is really a fantastic background for what Andy is now focusing on, because recently he's become more active in social advocacy, spending more time helping others with meaningful social projects, helping him to determine his next steps as a political and social change agent. We're about to begin our discussion with Andy in a moment, but let me remind our listeners, this is a call-in show. Yep. Call in at 888-429-5471. That's 1-888-429-5471. Please keep your questions and comments connected to the theme of this show, which is dissolving polarized obstacles to political solutions. Andy, good morning.
Good morning.
Speaking with you for the first time on Lynn's show, Lynn the Mr. Killer show.
You seemed interested in how I spoke about trying to find consensus and common ground with people who may not agree with you. We live in an arena where we tend to speak with those who are already on board with our ideas. But when you talk about empowerment, community empowerment, social empowerment, planetary empowerment, empowerment's going to derive from the larger whole of people, not just those we hang with. We run the risk of being ghettoized among those who we already agree with and are preaching to the choir.
That's right. Well, You know, in trying to set up this organization, the Coalition for Planetary Empowerment, I realized that in defining the objectives, and a lot of those are concerned with citizen human rights, it's kind of difficult to really get things straight unless you really understand what people actually mean by their human rights. And if you want to get consensus on something, just because you're interested in, say, whether it's gun control or you're interested in cleaning up the environment, you have to get very specific and very close to what they actually mean. And so you can eliminate discord within the group that you're supposed to be moving towards some kind of electoral position.
Well, before getting into how we go about it, I just want to say one quick statement about why that's important. Computer systems, family system, human systems, social systems, natural systems, these are all systems, networks of systems, systems of networks. And by definition, we as people in these systems are co-creating and co-defining our surroundings and our environment all the time. We cannot deny our connection to each other, even though we might try. So when we empower others, we are by definition empowering ourselves. And when we help others, quote, win, we win too. Unlike earlier eras in our evolution where the win-loss was the model because it was a model of scarcity, in the information age, there's no scarcity of information. There's no zero-sum game. We can all do well. And so why we relate to others is because when we do that, we are also part of that successful equation. When I meet a person, well, there's several ways to relate to people. There's formal negotiation where people going into the situation already have a vested interest to come out with something. But on the street or in the coffee shop, there's not necessarily an interest on the part of everybody to find an answer. Some people are afraid to discuss topics that scare them. Some people have opposing point of views based on their family, religious, or environmental background. So how you relate to a particular person or people really kind of depends on the specific context, but there's some general things I found to be true. One thing I found to be true is to always listen. Listen to where they're coming from. Maybe you can get hints from what they discuss about their life, about what their interests are. Never assume that yours is the ultimate answer. Always know that you can always derive something from other people. In every interaction, in every person, you can learn something. Be ready to change your own views. Be prepared to go gently in situations where someone might be brittle or easily threatened. I try to find out what's common between me and that person. For instance, if it's on a political issue like healthcare or I know you're interested in gun safety or voting rights or whatever. They usually have most people have a view, at least enough to kind of discuss it. And you might have to back off your perspective for a minute and find what's common with them. I find, as an example, I rarely, when I'm talking with a stranger, I rarely identify my, quote, ideology. Instead, I look for what part of me relates to them, and we find a commonality first. Another thing I've found is everyone's a subject to their own information source. And a lot of people rely on one source of information. And if you are perceived as challenging it, you're perceived as challenging them. It's better to take their information and do your own objective study. For instance, I was speaking with someone about an issue, and the subject of George Soros came up, and he was involved in human trafficking, according to this person. Now, I'd never heard that. And I know that George Soros has been a convenient whipping boy for certain people of some ideology, but to be fair, so have a lot of other people. So in order for another person to accept my views on someone they are accustomed to hearing, I have to be open to their views as well. I have to take what they say at face value, do my own research on the validity of their views, and I might be surprised. I might find out that they were really right. Or I might then be able to go with them with a clear heart and say, well, here's what I found out. Your view isn't true, but here's why, and give some respect to their view. They want, let them know that you cared enough to think seriously about what they had to offer. In this partisan environment, there's too much name-calling and demonizing, and a lot of it is because a few people in power use that as a tool to separate us by playing on our fears.
Well, I think also, I think also there's the problem is, mainstream media, say for someone like George Soros, goes several different ways.
I don't know much about him, actually.
Well, he's funded a lot of different things. And there are claims that these are some of the things that he's founded are very bad. But the point is that alternative media is also bifurcated. People think of alternative media, well, it's an alternative to major media, but it's not at all necessarily of one color. It's very, very different. And I can listen to something about Syria, the recent attack on Syria, and I can find five different points of view. And
the funny thing about that is there may be elements of truth to each of those points of view.
Exactly. What I found, even in listening to, MSNBC and CNN, which I find to be extremely biased, and also Fox News, which I find biased, I still find that the people who have taken a position are very good at the opposition. They're very bad at looking at themselves.
I think that's intentional. I think it's a design, yes, either to assuage their psychological needs or to sell advertising.
Well, I don't think it's just either one of those things. I think it's to assuage the government influence also. Especially
we're getting to a point now where media is beginning to bend the government to its will.
I don't really think that's correct. That, in my opinion, it's the opposite. It's not. I don't believe they really have the freedom to not listen to their corporate and government agendas, which are both often related.
And it seems to me that the corporate agenda is more powerful than the government agenda right now. At least that's what it seems to me.
No, I don't think so personally. But it depends on what area you're talking about. But when it comes
and
to things
intelligent like, people. And we can differ on our views, and maybe there's components of truth to each of our views that work together.
Well, there's undoubtedly components of truth, in my opinion, to it being influenced by their sponsors and trying to, that would be an influence. But when you get to the actual geopolitical stuff, a lot of the sponsors who are like pharmaceutical sponsors, they don't really care. But what they obviously, if you see what they're focusing on now, which is a lot has to do with Russia and Russia's involvement and their influence in the elections and how they ignore other people's influence in the elections, you can see that they have a bias towards government in certain respects. Now, there's a big difference between those respects in Fox and CNN and MSNBC. But
sometimes it's difficult to differentiate between purposeful agendas and a coincidental collision of similar motives.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it is difficult. It's difficult to discern about anything that you're getting third hand, isn't it? I mean, whatever we think about in terms of our opinions about anything that we talk about in this program, which is human and citizens' rights, there are usually multiple opinions and often completely conflicting opinions by witnesses.
One of the issues you brought up, though, is interfacing with others. And when you are interfacing with people who already have an interest in determining what their beliefs are, that's one thing. But there are a number of people who don't consider it a priority in their life to inform themselves or to take action. Maybe they feel there's no use to them. Maybe they feel overwhelmed by their daily, day-to-day affairs. But there's a large number of people who are not invested in multiple information sources or civic activism, but they're still people and they still have to give their consent for government and they deserve just as much rights as we do.
I agree that they deserve rights, but I also, I can't put this in a statistical way, but it seems to me that the American people are largely asleep when it comes to really focusing on the news in any kind of analytic way.
Until it hits their pocketbook or bangs down their door, then all of a sudden they wake up.
Yeah. And sometimes what government tries to do is to wake them up to a specific issue whether or not it's in a truthful way.
And that's the notion behind representative government. When our country was founded, only white men of property were allowed to vote, the thought being that they were the only ones educated enough on the topics to do justice to them. So we have a country that presupposes we elect people and we infuse in them our trust to do the right thing. And the problem is that our current governmental system tends to reward fundraising skills and obeisance to leadership rather than statesmanship. And that, I think, is a serious problem.
Yeah, I think it's a serious problem when people believe things that were told to them from the outside, from their parents.
Well, you know, you look at the healthcare, the omnibus budget bill that was just passed, or the Affordable Care Act. These are 3,000- and 4,000-page bills that basically are given to the representatives the night before the vote. And they don't have a chance to read them. They have staffers try desperately to pick out a few things. And that coupled with their political partisan lines of authority that they must follow or they won't get campaign funding, et cetera, it's sort of perverted the democratic system.
Extremely. I mean, to imagine a bill that's 1,000 pages and you've got a couple of hours to read it, it's obviously impossible. I mean, I remember hearing Rand Paul really get mad about this. It was very dramatic. But
I like him. I don't always agree with him, but I like him. I like his spunk.
Well, I think that he and his father are very good in terms of freedom. I think they understand freedom very well. But when it comes to
I do like the libertarians, but I have a concern that some of the extreme libertarians don't, because of their own emotional injuries, they don't understand that we have the right to our liberty, but it must not infringe on others' right to liberty, and that's where we get into the trick.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
every ideology has, you know, many components, right? You know, no matter how extreme you can get, you're going to find the ideology still is fragmented somewhat.
But I think that 80% of the American population is relatively centrist in most of their views. For instance, you have expressed an interest in gun safety. I know that the vast majority of gun owners are for universal background checks. They don't want to see weapons in the hand of the mentally ill. Reasonable things. But unfortunately, our government policies are being governed by very influential agencies who have financial motives at the heart of their reasoning. And I could see why people who live 10 miles apart want the right to shoot deer with some restrictions. That's fine. I can see why people living in a brownstone in Brooklyn want the right to defend themselves and their families. I can see that's fine. But in my personal view, an AR-15 with a bump stock that's designed specifically to take as many lives or to deprive as many people of their right to liberty and livelihood as possible is not appropriate, because your right to freedom does not trump their right to their freedom and their life. And that's where we get into the discussions about freedom, the tension between freedoms. And that's what our founders had to wrestle with when they developed it. Did you know that the original developing documents were based, the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was a paraphrase from the Virginia Declaration. And in the Virginia Declaration, they added the word safety. And by extension, you could add the word health.
Did Jefferson write that too?
George Mason did, but Jefferson sort of paraphrased him. We have the right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and safety and good health, because you can't pursue liberty and happiness without safety and good health.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think there is where we part with a lot of libertarians, right?
Well, I love libertarians.
Not everybody, but I'm just saying quite a few.
I respect very much the libertarian perspective. But there are a few people at the fringe of libertarians who are not truly libertarians. They are reacting to maybe their own upbringing. They're so anti-authoritarian that they can't think clearly. I happen to agree with the libertarians that what you do in the privacy of your own home, as long as it doesn't affect me, I say, you know, consenting adults, whatever you do, it's your business. I'm entirely in favor of that. I don't find that, and our founders agreed, I don't find that the government dictating your personal morality is a wise maneuver. It's not practicable anyway.
Andy, we've got to we're going to take a break in a second. I want to just say that one of the things that I do is I have a company called New Galaxy Enterprises, which develops content, all kinds of content, as you'll see in a minute. And after that little message, we're gonna play a really nice song that was from Zave Music, which is run by Zave Nathan, who sings on the track, who is really a tremendous musician, producer, singer, songwriter, and often works with his wife. She's also really good, Bonnie Blazak. We'll play C5 and M5, please.
Dr. Hugo Rodier has published 4 books on health issues covering practically all chronic health problems. You may find them by accessing his website at hugorodier.com. That's HUGORODIER.com. Gut health is the most academic, while switching off chronic disease is the most patient-oriented, with simple recipes to implement his nutritional protocols. And here's a beautiful ballad by Zave Music called Believe.
Where to start? Stay strong and keep loving us. And we mustn't forget who we are. As our future and past are written in the stars. Every day of our life we should pray to the sky. We are one, we are loved. Much loss, and for that we will grieve. In the end, it is love we'll receive. And we mustn't forsake.
You know, this is a call-in radio show, and our number is 1-888-429-5471. So if you'd like to talk to Andy and me, just call 1-888-429-5471. Please keep your questions and comments connected to the theme of the show, Dissolving Polarized Obstacles to Political Solutions. So, Andy, I would like to go over various political topics which are familiar to anyone in the United States who's ever seen a news program. Let's go back to health policies, particularly health benefits, like we've discussed a little bit briefly. In my opinion, the government has an obligation to make sure that all of its citizens have excellent health care. Perhaps we can pick apart the assumptions going into this kind of soundbite and see what varied meanings it could have and the other types of proposals and opinions people have about health care. Our country is heavily divided about this, and Congress is in a perpetual stalemate.
Well, I think the stalemate that Congress is in is due to the things we've discussed, the difficulties of our political system in terms of its partisan influence for money. I think people are not in a stalemate about health care, but I do think we have some differences. You believe that the government should provide health care. There are a lot of people who believe it should not, for various reasons. You may disagree with their reasons. And what we need to do is to get together and find out what the reasons are.
I know that Rand and Ron Paul, like their idea is that if the market was really free, then everything would be cool and we would be, people would, you know, healthcare would be affordable. And, you know, I myself question that.
Well, even the proponents of capitalism realize there are times when capitalism should be regulated. And even many staunch business officials realize that when you add the profit motive into something such as healthcare, you sort of poison the well. One of the things that's blocking our way, our ability to find consensus on issues like this, is the rhetoric. For instance, the healthcare discussion was all about health insurance. We still haven't really discussed healthcare. Did you notice that?
I do agree with that, and also the healthcare that we would be discussing if we're dealing with the majority of the use of healthcare is very influenced by the pharmaceutical community and the medical community with very expensive different kinds of specialty surgery and other types of operations like that.
Well, isn't that an analogous problem to the issue of the social economic system, where you want to reward innovation to a certain point but also provide a basic safety net? It's the same systemic problems no matter what the issue. And then there's the issue with healthcare. People will tell you they don't want the government to provide something because it means inherently waste and inherently your interests aren't taken at heart. But what they don't understand is corporate controlled healthcare suffers from the same problems. So by saying it shouldn't be government run, you don't necessarily escape the reasons why. So we get
look at the cost of, not that I like most of them, but the cost of prescriptions in this country is extremely high, higher than I think almost anywhere else in the world.
And they're getting the same drugs often from the same company.
And the government can't bid on the prescription drugs for Medicare or you know what I mean?
Your politicians would rather tell you that Medicare is going to go bankrupt than tell you we're going to negotiate drug prices. They'd rather succumb to the financial pressure of pharmaceutical companies and then use it as an excuse to diminish so-called entitlement. I hate that word, entitlement. It's all about political presentation and digging through the rhetoric to find the truth. So I believe everyone should have health care. I'm not particularly concerned about who provides it, except that whoever provides it should not engage in the activities that cause people to be afraid of the government. Whoever provides it should not be focused first and foremost on financial profit. They should not create systems that are overwhelmed with bureaucracy. I agree with all those things. So far, in my personal view, the best system is privatized healthcare paid through tax money. Most people call that single payer. And it needs to be streamlined, not subject to technological lobbying for huge onerous technological systems. The problems need to be solved, and we need to avoid the trigger words, government. You shouldn't be afraid.
You said privatized healthcare, didn't you, Andy?
Well, I believe that what I mean is, I believe that healthcare can be provided by so-called private service providers as well as so-called government providers.
You're not talking about insurance, though, when you say privatized.
No, I'm talking about the care itself. I'm talking about the care itself.
Yeah, I see. Yes. Yeah, I understand
that. We get bogged down on telling you why to be afraid of something instead of how to make it work. So we talk about health insurance. If we did healthcare right, we might not even need insurance for the first thing. But secondly, if we focus on health care, the insurance is secondary. The insurance is a profit growth. It's a business. It's not an inherent requirement. Or maybe insurance may be an inherent requirement, but we're focusing on the wrong thing. We have the highest quality health care in the world for those who can afford it, and the rest of us just kind of have to, you know, for now we're allowed to go to the emergency room for now, even if we can get in line.
I want to dispute something there. I don't think we have the highest quality health care, because a lot of the health care that's of the highest quality is measured by the technology and the pharmaceuticals, and it's not necessarily the natural type of solutions that don't have these terrible side effects or don't cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Okay, I use that phrase specifically so that those people who feel attacked if their own country's healthcare system is not the best, it allows them, it's a conceit, a poetic conceit for those people who don't want to face reality.
All right. Well,
there are a lot of people who can't bear the fact that their country might be 29th in this and 47th in that. They've got to believe we're first. So what you have to say to those people is, yeah, well, we might be first on paper, but rather than disputing that we're first, which is just getting into a tug of war with those people. So I use a lot of these verbal conceits and shortcuts. I agree with you. What quality means is different than what certain headlines might propose. I entirely agree with you. It's just in the matter of discussion.
The thing is that you have, not only are the prices of pharmaceuticals so outrageous for people who think they need them and often do, it's also the research involved is often done by the companies that are making these things.
If you have a dispute, you go to an arbitrator that's paid by the company, And the companies profit the most not from curing you, but from getting you hooked on medication. The profit model is not designed to work. The financial profit model is not humane, not the best for human well-being.
One of my debates about things related to this is the word Bernie Sanders says he's a democratic socialist. And I've thought a lot. I believe that most countries are a blend of, socialist, communal type of collective type of financing and private capitalism. So they're all sort of a blend of it, some going towards more socialism, some towards more capitalism. But I prefer the word, because what we're talking about here, Andy, is what I would call predatory capitalism, where there's
unbridled free market, whatever you
unbridled free market, predatory. But I like the word cooperative capitalism. I'd rather stress that, and this is again for the purposes of presentation too, because cooperative capitalism means that you will concede that certain things need to be more handled by the government, and certain things need to be more private. But
there should be a
win-win objective.
Win-win. The reason the pharmaceutical companies are playing in a win-lose game. That's the problem. They're playing in a win. The unbridled free market classically is a win-lose game. I agree with you about a social safety net base with a reward on top. The reason Bernie used that term, not only does it reflect a political leaning common in Europe, but he was trying to fight some preconceived notions from the past about the word socialism. I agree with you, it isn't a good term. He was kind of making do as another conceit.
Well, I mean, yeah, he was jumping in, and those countries that are democratic socialist countries have much more of what I would think would be valuable, and so does he, than what we have now.
They have a lot bigger safety net than we do.
And I don't think they're necessarily, each one of them is perfect. But
I try and stay away from that word socialism. Do you know that the U.S. military is one of the most socialist programs in our country? They provide health care and social services for all their people. It's very quote-unquote socialist in its nature. But you try and tell someone who was born in the 50s about this, they're American, they ain't no socialists. It's all in the packaging and the phrasing. You can deliver the same program to two different people. You can deliver it to a staunch capitalist by phrasing it one way. You can deliver it to a staunch socialist by phrasing it another way. They can be the exact same program packaged different ways.
Well, I think one of our goals would be, even though that's true, and I'm sure that's true in terms of media promotion of anything in this respect, but I think it would be nice as people learn to think more analytically and not look so much at the way the phrase is, but look at the way it's used. Like Ludwig Wittgenstein said, the meaning is the use.
Discussing among analytical and rational people, I agree. But for those people who are emotional, passionate, and reactive, their first stop is the words.
I agree, too. Yeah, I agree totally. I'm saying that in terms of working with people who are interested in developing their understanding of the political processes and how to correct them, they need to be clear-minded. And that, of course, then they may have to use some of these methodologies to communicate.
Okay, you think that the government should provide health care, right, to everybody? You may think
don't. I actually don't necessarily. In other words, I'm not writing the law right now, but I think one could infer
from the passage of the Constitution or the Declaration that the government looking out for the public, was it the public welfare? I think one could infer that health care is part of that.
I think that, I think even if you had health care provided by the government, there's probably should be a little bit of allowance for some kind of alternative for people who want or need it. Maybe some privatization.
I'm glad you said that because as we develop, we're a coalition of people. And as we develop coalition solutions, we may need a solution that involves more than one offering, choice among several offerings. It doesn't have to be one size fits all answer.
You know, you have the perfect world, and then you have the compromise world, which we naturally we're in. And yeah, but the fact is, our country, in terms of a developed nation, has gone so far away from what the common healthcare is, you know, in other countries that are developed like we are. So
yeah,
it's kind
sometimes
of
a it's a wise choice to fly to another country to get some of your healthcare needs taken care of.
Okay, now I want to move on to another area of interest, and that area is war. The authority to declare war. And because I can be kind of rational when it comes to healthcare. I think I haven't spoken to – I lost my decorum about that. But when it comes to the authority to declare war, for instance, when Syria recently was attacked, I had to really fight not to be extremely angry about it. I feel violated. Personally feel violated when war does not follow the strict guidelines of the Constitution, which means that Congress declares war. And I in my opinion, this is my opinion, is that I'm not interested in the War Powers Act. I don't think that conforms to what we need in terms of Congress having the power. And I see independent actions of the executive in Syria, but I see them in the Gulf Wars, in Afghanistan, Vietnam, Korea, drone strikes, and all these proxy wars where we're really actually involved in a war using other people or funding them.
And the sad part is sometimes our military feels they're used too for the wrong reasons.
Right. So what I'm talking about here is not just – I'm saying that I start to approach a level of emotional – anxiety and anger when it comes to this subject. Not now, because I'm talking about it abstractly, but when it comes down to it, I can get really mad. And I think that in the
is it specifically the abdication of Congress responsibility to war and only war, or is it the issue of Congress abdicating its responsibility that bothers you?
Well, it bothers me in many respects, but I remember the Senator Gruning in the Vietnam War making this point. Here we are in a major war again, and look at what we're doing. Congress hasn't declared war. Now, in the Korean War, we didn't declare war either, but it was a United Nations war. It was kind of
a war, at least it was debated in a public forum. It was a police action. But the point that I'm getting at is I think there's so many issues here, but I think what you're upset about is to do something like engage in military action, we should have public debate and responsible citizens should discuss the ramifications. Whereas if the unitary executive just orders it, they can do it for whatever profiteering, they can go for oil in Iraq, whatever.
I think there's a reason that the founding fathers wanted Congress to declare war. And that is because as they are supposed to represent us and they are supposed to debate and they are supposed to control that, because as I think I heard Rand Paul say recently, Madison said, you know, he was quoting from Madison saying the executive branch is more likely to want to control war. And in our country, we have a civilian commander in chief. But I'm saying I'm not just talking about whether it's right or wrong. I'm talking about my emotions involved. My emotions
whether it's war or not, it disturbs me emotionally. Whether it's healthcare or war or omnibus spending, it disturbs me emotionally that a system that's set up where my elective representative is supposed to look at the issues, their staff is supposed to analyze the issues. Instead, they abdicate their responsibility in any one of a number of ways. In the case of war, it's an outright abdication. But in the other cases, they're still abdicating their responsibility. In those other cases, they're leaning toward lobbyist control instead of presidential control. It's also a break in our constitutional system, but it doesn't have the same extreme results that war does.
Well, you see, in terms of you know, this program is about the relationship between spirituality and human rights. And I believe that certain ideas and even phrases in the Constitution are aligned with spirit, which means that in a certain state of awareness, a certain, what I would call a spiritual state of awareness, one which also has been called by many names, the divine presence, the Shekinah, the kingdom of God, source, those ideas are very comfortable. And human conscience which is a normal state of, you know, a person doesn't have to be in some spiritual state to have conscience, concern about other people, is a reflection of that holy state. And so,
and I believe reading about how our founding fathers acted, in my opinion, they gave a lot of thought to their incarnation of those issues. Whereas now we have a system that selects representatives for their ability to engage in certain primal activities rather than be thoughtful and stop and contemplate ramifications from a spiritual perspective. The system itself has come to select out. We need to, as the Declaration says, we need to reform and alter the current system so that it allows for our representatives to have the desire and impetus to engage in that contemplative, connective realm that's required.
Well, my co-host, Dr. Rodier, he's a 32nd degree Mason, and he's very interested in the role of the founding fathers. You know, the Masonic, there was a tremendous Masonic influence, and it's probably why so many of the things that are in the Declaration and in the Constitution are really more advanced than the things that were actually carried out, like the Constitution, like you pointed out, is like white property owners, but still there's the statement, all men are created equal.
And yeah, well, I prefer all people are created equal now in the 21st century, but I agree.
Well, what I'm saying is that
when they were founding the Constitution,
their ideals were aligned on a higher level than maybe their actual implementation of those ideas in the actual workings of the Constitution, the government. But they have led to progressive changes in that area. So that more and more, until a certain point, probably most dramatically 9/11, we were headed towards more and more, broadening power, broadening human rights. Look, we need to take another short break, if you'll forgive me, Andy. What we're going to listen to now is we're going to listen to a very interesting book that I was associated with as a co-author, which I work with. I work with a guy who was a Korean War veteran, and this became like a screenplay and a book. The book is actually out. It's called Boots in Manhattan, and this story is about the beginning of his life when he was in a gang in the 1940s as a kid, very young, and then later on he left and he joined the he joined the Marines, and he wound up fighting the Communist Chinese when they invaded. And this is actually it's a novel based on partially based on his story, which is in another book called West Side Warrior. Here it is, Boots in Manhattan, founded by another statement about what our mission at New Galaxy Enterprises is.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who is a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Ramblers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of the stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was 6. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditch the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
Andy, if you're you know, in charge of the media, say some kind of television PSA, you know, or to promote a cause, or perhaps an ad for cable television for a good cause, how do you deal with the depolarization of finding common ground when you cannot actually confront an individual who's viewing your presentation? How do you deal with this problem in mass media?
I haven't really spent that much time from a media producer perspective, but watching the media, it's mostly been used by political consultants trying to derive a particular outcome in a particular demographic using persuasive techniques in the choice of visuals in their ads. There's been a presumptive assumption that people are not interested in doing what's right or finding out more, that they're passive absorbers of the media, but I don't agree. I think there may be room for not just PSAs, but an actual citizen's channel. When I've seen attempts at so-called progressive programming, whether it's Al Gore's TV channel or was it Air America Radio, they seem not to succeed, but I'm not entirely sure it's not because it's not a good idea.
Well, I'm firmly interested in the coalition in developing the social network side of it to have actually the news in one level, on another area, to be able to discuss the particular initiatives and campaigns that the people involved and the members have. But I definitely
about Syria, right? What if you had a media outlet that provided an in-depth look at all the perspectives? Remember, it's multiple perspectives of, say, the Syria situation. Conventional thinking says, oh, no one wants to watch that, and we can't sell advertising. But I think there is an audience for perspective.
I definitely agree. That was how it used to be. I mean, with all its flaws. You know, the thing is, we're at a point, we're kind of getting towards the end of the game here, Andy. I need to play a little message about what my co-host does, Hugo Rodier,
please,
who will be joining us again next week.
So it's been my pleasure. I hope I can be on sometime in the future.
We'll be talking in a few minutes. C5.
Dr. Hugo Rodier has published 4 books on health issues covering practically all chronic health problems. You may find them by accessing his website at hugorodier.com. That's H-U-G-O-R-O-D-I-E-R. GutHealthIER.com. Gut health is the most academic, while switching off chronic disease is the most patient-oriented, with simple recipes to implement his nutritional protocols.
Well, again, thank you, Andy, for being with us today.
Thank you.
I want to thank, first of all, I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom, who have developed this incredibly wonderful radio station or radio stations that are really serving the true needs of people, both from a standpoint of getting voices that would normally be blocked out by major media, but also by providing listeners with fresh, interesting, and important information. I also want to thank Hassan Khan for his help in all things related to my company, New Galaxy Enterprises, including the broadcasting component, Lynn the Mystic Healer for her amazing contributions to the Coalition for Planetary Empowerment. She's going to be our in charge of member services. Edgar Ahrens for the bumper music. He's a composer from Russia. And Patricia Welch, singer extraordinaire, for the song My Heart Is Ready, which was composed by Edgar Ahrens based on lyrics that I created to fit his haunting memory. So we're going to go say goodbye, and then afterwards we'll go out with My Heart Is Ready, a song. So if you would, play INF, the extra, and M5.
Thanks for joining Dr. Rodier and I on Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition. As we go about developing our new organization, the Coalition for Planetary Empowerment, we hope you will consider the importance of taking part in the electoral processes of your government and asserting the rights you have to vote for the companies you respect and love by casting your ballot as a shareholder or as a consumer with what you buy. We hope soon to make this possible through a social network responsive to your needs to dialogue about your rights as a citizen, but also to be able to effectively act in concert with like-minded colleagues to find representatives of government and business executives will hear your voice and appreciate your message. See you soon.